Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us today. We're going to be talking today on Garden Talk about how you can change out your high-maintenance lawn with some wonderful alternatives. And our guest is Jeff Epping. He's Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. And I hope you'll join in. What would you like to know about alternative lawns? How's your landscaping doing this year? I bet you've been doing a lot of mowing if you've got some grass. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Love to hear from you. And Jeff Epping, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me, Larry. It's always a pleasure.
I tell you what, it's always fun to have you here. And before, we've already have several people calling in. They may or may not want to be talking about lawns or getting rid of grass lawns. But let's talk a little bit about that. There seems to be a movement away from the traditional grass lawns. And when did you get so interested in it?
Well, I think, you know, in this line of work, as things have gone over the last many years, you know, we're all trying to do more environmentally friendly gardening. You know, it's better for the environment. It's better for the gardener because nobody really wants to be using, you know, chemicals on a daily basis or weekly basis, whatever it is, to maintain anything. And we know so much more about how important our pollinators and insects are, which support our birds, which everybody loves, and all those things. So it just makes everybody wants clean water and be safe and enjoy their garden and have a beautiful garden, too. So you know, it kind of stems from that.
I'm just thinking about this. You know, it wasn't that long ago that the highly manicured lawn really got started here in this country. Aren't they relatively new to America?
I think, I think when, you know, we really started settling this country and going back to our European roots, you know, we hearkened back to those, you know, mown lawns, and maybe back then they were mown by sheep or whatever, yeah. But, you know, they were this nice green space. And so we brought that along with us, and being a very agriculturally minded society back then and even now, I think, you know, it goes back to our roots. But I think now people are looking for alternatives for many reasons.
And you've got some great ones, gravel gardens ones, but talk about some of the ideas that you've got.
Sure. I mean, if you come over to Olbrich, you can see the whole gamut. I mean, we do have bluegrass turf because we have some green space where we have concerts and we have gatherings, sure, and parties and that sort of thing. And that, you know, I have no problem with that. I think we all need a little space to throw a ball, frisbee, that sort of thing. But the excess of just all the lawns where nobody sets foot on them but the guy in the mower or riding across them or spraying them or doing all those things. So at Olbrich, we have the lawn, but then we have alternatives, and they could be something as simple as another type of grass. I mean, we have some fine fescue, we call little meadow gardens. We have turf-type tall fescue areas that are very similar looking to the traditional Kentucky bluegrass lawn, but they require a lot less water. They're very drought-tolerant grass. So we get away from that. And some of them, some of the no-mow mixes, we only mow them a couple times a year.
Yeah.
And they don't require a lot of fertilizer like Kentucky bluegrass either. So they're a good alternative. But yet, if you want to go a step further, then you can do more of a mixture of other flowers mixed in with it. So it's more of a meadow, more like a native prairie would be. And we have all different sort of sizes, if you will, you know, some that are only about 2 feet tall and some that are much more. And then we transition into just perennial beds and mixed shrub borders. So like the picture you showed of your home, what used to be your front lawn is now daylilies and a mixture of different perennials. And, you know, those are a great alternative and certainly less maintenance, overall than maintaining a lawn, right? So it's kind of a mindset, too, because I think people are like, I don't know anything about perennials. I don't, you know, it's going to be too hard and I'm going to be spending so much time. But it's like anything. You just got to do a little research, figure out what to plant, and if you plant the plants that are well adapted to your soils and you know, the exposure, whether it be shade or sun or whatever. Do that research up front. If you need professional help to create a design, do that, because that's a good use of your money. Because once you get it in the ground, if you have plants that want to be there and thrive in those conditions, it'll be that much easier to maintain them. And then we're providing flowers and habitat for wildlife, insects, birds, all those things, where a lawn is kind of a desert to a lot of the wild life. There's really not a lot going there for them.
And, you know, I should admit, the photo that Jeff's talking about is up on my Facebook page. Our Facebook page is, the title of it's The Larry Mealer Show. So if you want to go and take a look at what Larry's front, quote, lawn looks like, you can go there. And you don't have to be a member of Facebook to just go and observe. So take a look at the Larry Mealer Show Facebook page, and you can see it there. And also we have a photo on Facebook of some grass, and someone, actually Brett, posted on Facebook and wonders what kind of grass is growing along the stone path in the photo that you provided for us, Jeff.
So this space was originally bluegrass turf. It's actually long and narrow, which you maybe not be able to see that in the photo. But it was perfectly happy in turf, and we mowed it for many years. And then we have a big ginkgo and another honey locust nearby, and they got bigger and bigger and shaded that lawn area. And it just struggled. Yeah. So we said, enough. And so we actually converted it to a sedge lawn. And so this is Carex pennsylvanica, or the Pennsylvania sedge. And
it's really pretty.
It is. And it's just, so we eliminated the turf that was there in the fall. The next spring, we just plugged in right through the dead turf with the sedges on about 10-inch centers. And over about 2 years, they all tillered just like any, you know, other turf grass, or many turf grasses do, and filled in all the gaps. So now what we do is we mow this once in the spring, and we let it go the rest of the season. And now that it's really tightly knit, there are very few weeds that come up, but there still are a few here and there. But when you think about, if this were lawn, we'd be mowing it every, 7 to 10 days?
Yeah.
And we'd be using all the chemicals to maintain that. Here, again, this plant is very well adapted to these semi-shady and shady conditions, and there is even a little dappled sun in there, but it's happy as a clam. Now, are you going to play golf or frisbee or croquet there? No, absolutely not. And if you notice in the photo, we have a flagstone stepping stones back to this little patio area, because this sedge will not take a constant traffic on it. It just won't hold up to that.
So that looks really nice too.
It does. It's beautiful.
That stone.
And so often when you look into that space, there's two people sitting there on those Adirondacks, you know, chit-chatting, enjoying their surroundings. So there's a really nice little spot.
More to talk about, but every one of our lines is filled. So let's go to the phones. Kristen in Bridge Creek, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Jeff. How are you today?
Oh, great, just peachy.
Great, great. Well, you know, Larry, because I have called in before, I'm a big lake advocate. I live on a lake in northwestern Wisconsin, and I'm involved with Wisconsin Lakes. And I am trying to encourage everybody, every riparian owner, to convert their lawn that goes right down to the lake. And I'm wondering if, Jeff, you could give some tips on how to both have an attractive shoreline and a viewing corridor, but still help with erosion and things that are good for wildlife along shorelines.
Good question. Thank you, Kristen. Jeff, you got some ideas, I bet.
Well, you bet. And I mean, there's a perfect example of where we shouldn't be maintaining lawns and fertilizing and having all that impact the beautiful lake that we all want to be around and enjoy, right? So certainly convert that over to plantings that will thrive. Most often in that situation, it's a sunny situation. You said you wanted a view, so you don't want anything too tall. I mean, there's so many great native plants that will be adapted to those conditions. So, you know, there's a lot of different, I mean, I think there's something like over 300 native sedges in the Midwest, or maybe even just in Wisconsin. And so those plants, which were very obscure in the past, You know, yeah. only botanists would know about them and such are now coming to the forefront. We're learning more about them. We have native plant nurseries that are producing them, which was always the hard thing. Even if you knew about them, you couldn't buy them anywhere.
Yeah.
But now you can. So, in a situation like that, you could, work with a local native plant designer who would do, prairies and woodland restorations, that sort of thing, and come up with a little plant palette to use in those conditions. And, it depends on where you're at, on what plants you select, and is it an area that floods often? Is it sandy soils, or is it a loam soil, or all those things? And it depends on where you're at in the state, because it varies widely. A lot of the plants that you would put along that edge could take seasonal flooding. So, and with all the rain we've had this year, they could be underwater for a week or two and bounce right back when the water recedes. And that's where it is important for erosion on shorelines, because if that were grass and that all that grass dies and then the water drops and now that
now
erodes back
right into the water,
all that fertility right in the water. The possibilities are kind of endless, and you could mix other woody plants into that situation too.
Sure.
Things like red twig dogwood would love that situation, and some of our other native trees and shrubs, that sort of thing. So it's a good point though. That's one of the places we really should not be maintaining lawns. Now, maybe farther up on the property and you're going to leave yourself that buffer along the lake to absorb all those nutrients before they hit the water, because like I said, it's sometimes nice to have a play area in your cottage or home.
Thanks again, Kristen. Let's go to Cindy in Viroqua next. Hi, Cindy. Thanks for calling.
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Living in Vernon County, we're one of the people that got slammed by storms this last week.
Yeah.
And so we lost a lot of trees and are wanting to replant. But, you can grind the stumps down, but there's still roots there. How do you deal with the roots as far as replanting other trees or plant material?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question. I mean, what you could do one of two things. Plant in the gaps, if you will. I mean, most root systems, the bigger, heavier roots are, far less numerous than all the feeder roots, which are farther out from the tree. So if you think about, say, if you're doing a shrub planting, your average shrub probably gets 5-6 feet wide. So that gives you some leeway to space them out between the roots. If you're planting something smaller, you could always add soil over the top of those roots and then compost over that and, plant into that. Now, that's for a tree that's dead. And I always talk to people because I see this and I just cringe when I see a rototiller underneath a large existing beautiful oak tree or maple or whatever, because you have to realize that, 90%+ of the root system is existing in the top 12 to 18 inches of soil. And if you go in there and start, damaging all those feeder roots, you are going to negatively impact that large tree. So you're talking about, a dead tree, so that's not as big a deal. But I wanted to throw that out there because it's something that's really, really, really damaging to large trees.
And there's no reason you can't plant between those roots that are...
Exactly. And even on a live tree. I mean, there you would just dig where you're planting your perennial most often, because you're going to use some shade-tolerant things, and start out small. Most of the meadow plantings we do and the gravel gardens that we do, we're just using small plugs. They're 2.5-inch size pots or plugs, so you don't need to start out with a 5-gallon or 1 gallon of this and that. They're more expensive, and they don't establish any quicker usually. So save your pennies, and you can get a lot more, and then plug them in. And if it's a big existing tree, maybe only plant with, about a quarter of the root zone this year, and then maybe another quarter next year. So you don't, again, impact that all at once, because no doubt you're going to be hitting some of those feeder roots, but trees are pretty resilient if you don't go overboard.
Yeah, if you don't go overboard. Cindy, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Old Brick Botanical Gardens in Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Right now, Jeff Epping with us to talk about kind of things you might do. Well, we're talking about all things in the garden here and in the lawn. We've zeroed in a little bit on the lawn today and moving at least partially away from grass lawns and what you can do. We've talked about a few things already. We haven't gotten into gravel gardens yet, but we'll get there. I want to get to some calls, though, first, because lots of people waiting. There is one opening at 800-642-1234, so you can give a call. We'll get you on pretty quick. Tom in Burlington, though, up next. Tom, hi. Thank you for calling.
I used to mow my lawn and make it look like an English manor house. I knocked myself out raking leaves and burning and going after the weeds. And then I found one of the wealthiest ladies in Wisconsin. She has a prairie garden. Mm. She has no lawn. It's stones that go to her house and so forth. So I let my lawn become a prairie garden, I call it. And it's really pretty when these natural long grasses we have get their tassels on them, and they look so beautiful in the sun when it's setting in the afternoons. And I wish they would do prairie gardens along the highways. We have these little manicured things, and why don't we just let them grow longer? And I get a lot of flack from my neighbors. I have about an acre, so I have probably enough land to do it. I'm in the woods. But this thing about manicuring your lawn and cutting it every 2 inches, it seems a little crazy to me. And we have such beautiful natural flowers in our state here.
Yeah, well...
Well, I agree with that. And I think one thing, you know, people just have a hard time sometimes getting over that sort of, it has to be manicured. What are my neighbors going to think? And that sort of thing. So, you know, when we first did our first fescue meadow at Old Brick, I kind of started out slow and more controlled looking. So we created these, a fine fescue meadow. And I thought, you know, if people want to see a prairie, they can go over to the Arboretum. They can see, you know, I have great examples of that since we've developed more. But that was our first go around. And I think sometimes you need to start out a little slower. So some of these no-mow mixes, which are still, you know, nice and green, but you only mow them a couple times a year and then, you know, transition to maybe something more. The beauty of even just those fine fescue blends that we've used, we've chocked them full of minor bulbs, so all the little diminutive bulbs mm-hmm. that come up every spring, and you know, we just kept adding more and more. I think there's got to be over 30,000 bulbs in this little 30 by 100 foot area, and it's one of the most popular spots in the garden every spring, because it's just one wave after the other of these bulbs, and then they just die back naturally. And we mow it in about early to mid-June, and we mow all that yellow bulb foliage off along with the grass. We compost it, because those grasses actually like low fertility, or at least they have a competitive advantage with low fertility. And so people were like, wow, this is cool. We can do this. And I have the same type of lawn at my home, mm-hmm. And there's quite a number of them popping up here and there around Madison. So sometimes things change a little slowly. But I have high hopes that we're getting there. And I think people are tired of mowing. And every Saturday, what do you hear all around you?
Right? Yeah, the lawnmowers are going. And sometimes if you're putting in, let's say, prairie-type plants, there are ways that you can maybe mow pathways or something through to let people know that this is a planned event that you're doing.
Very true. And you can design it and such. So where if you had a huge acreage, you'd be seeding it, right? So because that's the most economical. But when you have a smaller space, you buy plugs, and you can really design it to look more garden-esque but still do the same job. And maybe you're not going to use big blue stem and Indian grass and those things, because they're immense if you have a small lot. But stick to prairie drop seed and little blue stem and then a lot of the other forbs that go along with it, the smaller, shorter, which maybe, you know, everything can be 3 feet or less, makes it a little more you know, fits
appealing
into the neighborhood.
To some eyes,
yeah. And they're perfectly nice and beautiful. And, you know, like I say, we're doing a lot of that at the garden as well. So, you know, if you want to see some cool examples of what we're talking about today, come on out to Old Brick. I mean, we're not that far away, no matter where you're at in the state. You could spend, you know, the whole day there.
Oh, easily.
Great restaurants down the street on Atwood and Woolley Street and that whole area. So, yeah, I'd say come out and see us, and I'm sure you can find something for you there.
And as long as we're on that, we should also mention you've got some butterflies are showing up at Old Brick.
Yeah, you bet. We have our annual Blooming Butterflies event, which is going on right now. It actually started yesterday and goes until August 13th, 10 to 4 daily. It's a great event. So all the butterflies are released in the conservatory. There's beautiful display cases of different species of butterflies from all over the world. It's real. And then you take in the garden. It's a great event. Yeah.
Let's go to Catherine next in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Catherine. Oh, I'm sorry. Kathleen.
Hi.
How are you today?
Hi, Larry. I put it on your Facebook, but I'm a former Madison person who started my native garden in there and was very popular, and then I moved to Delavan. And after 6 years of very, very hard work, I'm having a native pollinator plant tour on the 5th of August. And it is 4,000 square feet of over 160 forbs, shrubs, vines, trees, so that people can see on a standard suburban city lot what they can grow, and they can see, and not in catalog, what might work for them. And I have catalogs, I have plots and suggestions for plants and free plants and posters, lots of other things to see. And I would love to have people come out. How should I do this? Put on your Facebook, or they can just call 262-215-6610. And any benefit will be to the Xerces Society and the Pollinators Partnership. It's a free tour, three homes. One is a lakeshore home that we're converting. It's very beautiful. And then mine. And I'd love to have people come out and support this. And it's exactly what you guys are talking about.
Fantastic.
The mowed grass in front, the pathways through the native plants, and shade, sedges,
so what's
all
that?
Kinds of things.
What's your number again? 262?
It's 262-215-6610.
Yeah,
and they could stop at Lake Geneva for, you know, make it a day and lots of fun. And free plants. It's good.
What's better than that to a gardener?
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you.
I appreciate it very much. I'm trying to find the photo that she put up here. I haven't found it yet, but it's there somewhere, I'm pretty sure. Well, on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. So let's go to Richard next in Ettrick. Richard, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning. Great show. Last couple of weeks, the deer have discovered my wife's hosta beds, these real large leaf hostas, and they've eaten the leaves off, left all the stems.
Oh, boy.
So two questions. One, can we cut those stems off down at ground level now, or do we have to wait, and will they come back next year?
Hostas are pretty tough.
Yeah, they're pretty tough, and the fact there's no blade left to them anyway. I don't think you're going to get much photosynthesis through those few petioles that are left. So, no, I would say you could do that. I don't know what you're planning on doing to protect them from the next browsing herd, but you might want to put some chicken wire over them. You know what we've done at Olbrich early in the spring, because the rabbits love to munch on a new spring growth especially, but we found some cheap hanging baskets where you would make a hanging basket planter, and oftentimes they're just wire forms, and those wire forms are great for just popping over the crown of a plant that you're trying to protect, and then as the plant starts to get bigger and grows through it, then you can take them off. But a lot of times animals like that really soft growth, and this time of year there's so much more for them to eat. However,
deer are
a little more a little rougher on plants than rabbits are usually.
Yeah, these plants were 3.5 feet high before they finally discovered them. So,
well,
I'm surprised. It's not their favorite food in the world, but of course they'll eat almost anything.
Yeah. Well, yeah, okay.
All right, thank you, Richard, for calling. Ellie in Eau Claire. Let's go to you next. Hi, Ellie.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on, Larry.
Sure.
I'm calling to give some hope to people who say they have brown or black thumbs. About 10 years ago, I started gardening, and now I have the most beautiful yard you wouldn't believe.
Hmm.
And it's just, you know, practice. You know, you just kind of get out there and you do it, and I read a lot about things like permaculture and sustainable farming and gardening. But long story short, about 5 years ago, I put in the Prairie Nursery no-mow lawn into my front yard. And it's all sedges and fescues. Looks really beautiful. And then I've got five perennial gardens surrounding the yard. But the interesting thing is when the sedges and the fescues start to set seed, they bloom very early in the year, like late May, early June. And they have these long seed fronds that come up that I think are beautiful, that many of my friends think are beautiful. But I had someone in the neighborhood who had just moved in and reported me to the city because my lawn was too long.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have any suggestions on how I've even thought about putting a sign out front saying, this needs to be here until the seeds mature, and then I'll cut it down.
A lot of people actually put small signs up in front of their lawn for, I've heard that from a number of people, just putting in something that says maybe it's prairie lawn in progress or something like that.
Right.
Okay.
And that tends to help.
Okay. Yeah, I thought it probably would, but I just wanted to, you know.
And then take a dozen cookies over to the one who complained.
Well, I've got two new neighbors, one across the street and one on the left side of it. So I don't know which one it was.
Well,
but I never had a problem before these two neighbors changed.
Mm-hmm. Cookies to both.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
And I think so much of that is educating people and getting them to understand why we're doing it and what wonderful wildlife it supports and how important it is. Because one of our earlier callers said, you know, why aren't we planting prairies along every roadside? And I'd say, yeah, why aren't we? Because we have created these deserts of, these. There's no corridors for wildlife anymore to get from one woodland to the next woodland or prairie or whatever it be, because we have so many agricultural fields in this country. So I think it's really important that we start looking at spaces that we have to maintain as open spaces, like power line corridors, like highway, you know, along all of our roadways. It's a lot of acreage. And if we were to start converting that all over to plants that support wildlife, it would go a long way. I mean, look at the monarchs that make that migration every year and the huge expanses that they have to migrate through that have very little for them. And but they could.
Right.
They could very easily.
And also, oh, shoot, I just lost my thought. yes, when you look out on fields these days, I mean, I'm 65, so, you know, I've been a child a long time here in Eau Claire and saw that the fields are now, instead of being cut up with hedgerows that have some cover in there for animals, they're just like acre after acre after acre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so true.
Yeah, so a lot of those hedgerows are gone, and so all the more reason to take your advice, Jeff.
Yeah, I think that is so important. I know a few years back in England, they were looking at eliminating all the hedgerows because they wanted to farm more efficiently. They wanted bigger machines. They wanted big open spaces and. There was a big uprising against it, and then they did a lot of research on how many different species of insects and birds and small mammals lived in all those fence rows, and it was enormous. And they stopped the practice.
Yeah.
And I think when I was a kid, I remember there was fence lines with the trees and shrubs and all that. It's rare to see that now.
Yeah. Thank you again, Ellie, for calling. Appreciate your call. Laura in Madison has something for us, so let's go there. Hi, Laura.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Well, we got a puppy who has chewed off almost all of the bark on our cherry sapling and a good portion of the bark on our firebush.
Oh.
And I think it just happened a few days ago.
Well, I don't have good news for you.
Because
on any tree, the outer bark is really where all the action is. That's where the live, what we call the cambium, is on a tree, and that's where, you know, the plant translocates nutrients, and so we say food. If that's completely stripped off all the way around, it will not.
It's a goner.
It won't come back that way. So, yeah, on a fruit tree, if you cut it back to that point, and it resprouts, oftentimes it'll be the rootstock because it's a grafted plant. If that's the case, it'll come back with some. Say it's an apple tree, it won't be an apple. It'll be a little, who knows, a wild apple, crab apple, something like that. So, to be honest, you'd probably better just starting over.
Yeah, and you can. You know, when you start over, there are things you can do to keep the dog. I mean, you could put some.
You bet.
Hardware cloth or something around that lower area to keep the dog from chewing.
Yeah, I've got a fence around it now.
Yeah. Well, take a look at it and see if it's girdled all the way around. Well, if it's girdled, that implies that it's all the way around.
Right.
If it's not? I think there might be like a third left of the bark.
Yeah, well, you know, you could leave it and see if it recovers, but it's never going to be a good, healthy tree. It'll probably develop a wound down there, which will be subject to some insect or disease more than likely at some point. And the good news, it's a small tree, right? It's just a sapling.
Yeah,
so you haven't lost a great deal of time. We've had crab apples at Olbrich that are maybe, you know, 10 years old, and we had voles come in one bad season and strip the bark off of those trees that we've had in the ground for, you know, eight plus years. And that was heartbreaking because there's no option. We had to cut them down and start over. But
there you go.
Lesson learned, I guess.
Yeah, thanks, Laura. Thanks for calling. Ben in Fremont, we'll go to you now. Hi, Ben.
Howdy, guys. Thanks for taking my call. So we've got a large, almost 6 acres, and we got a big pond, and a lot of it's mowed, but we have a low-lying area that's probably 3/4 of an acre, so it's hard to mow it anyways because it stays wet a lot, so I decided to stop mowing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it took off. It's probably like 3 feet tall, and it's predominantly a grass that has like a purple hue to it. You know, when you look out across there, it kind of looks purplish. Wondered if that's good, bad, indifferent, and maybe, you know, should I burn it, mow it once a year to, you know, I don't know if it'll get taken over by weeds eventually. You know, I don't know. It's pretty big grass, though.
Right. So it is important if you want to keep it to grass so that you would mow it at least once a season because, you'll get weeds, you'll get tree seedlings coming in there. Birds are spreading, you know, seed all the time, especially, you know, if you're underneath a larger tree or something, you'll find a plethora of different growth coming up. Oftentimes it's invasive species, unfortunately, like buckthorn or honeysuckle or something, that the birds are eating the fruit and dispelling them there. But anyway, yeah, if you want to keep it lawn, you have to at least mow it once a season to keep it. Usually spring is when I would recommend that you do that because a lot of our insects actually overwinter on that on the plants that are there, and it's good to let them do their thing in the early spring, and then you can mow and not damage those.
Follow-up question, is burning it an option? Just because that area is pretty wet, like I said, all the time. Well, not late August, probably, or the fall, you know, when it doesn't get as much rain, but you know, it's hard to mow, and that's kind of why I quit mowing it to begin with.
Right, right. I don't, you know, if I could see exactly what those plants, I mean, if it's a native prairie grass, like you were saying, a purple hue, sometimes a little blue stem has that sort of purple hue to it, but it's really, if you have real gas, not seeing it. But our native prairie grasses, which are warm season grasses, are very well adapted to burning. Without seeing what you got,
sure.
If it's dries up and it'll keep burning.
Yeah.
It's always an option. I think all grasslands can be burned if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. So,
If I took a picture of it and sent it, could I email it to somebody or something that you could say, oh yeah, that's this and A, you don't want it, or B, you can mow it, or C, you can mow or burn it.
Actually, if you've got one, have you got a photo now?
No, I would have to take. I should have took one before I left earlier, but I didn't.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say you could have posted it up today before the show's over, and Jeff could probably take a look at it.
Yeah.
Or I don't know.
You want to email it to me? You can do that. If you're driving, you go to our website. And on our website is a list of all of our staff, and my email address will be on there for you.
So just at Old Break Gardens.
Yeah, so it's japping@cityofmadison.com is what it is, actually.
Perfect. Thank you.
You bet.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Sean in Stanley, going to you now. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My question is kind of along the same lines as the last caller, but I mow about 7 acres right now. I got about 3 of which that's very wet in the spring. And, of course, this year it's wet all the time now. And, you know, the mower gets stuck. You can't even hardly walk down there. And I've talked with my wife. We've discussed, you know, maybe a natural prairie or even the possibility of a, like, wetland, but we're not real sure,
mm-hmm.
you know, what our options are.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you knew any resources or any recommendations that we could, you know, look at.
You bet.
See what our options are.
Yeah, you bet. There's a lot of native plant nurseries here, there, and everywhere through the state. But Larry has a wonderful guest on from time to time by the name of Neil DeBoll from Prairie Nursery in Westfield. He's one that comes to mind, and I've actually worked with him on a number of projects myself. But I think you need an expert to come in and tell you, kind of identify what your situation is, because there are dry prairies and there are wet prairies, and there's all different types of prairies in between, and the right plants need to be utilized to make it successful. So the first thing you do, I think, is consult someone, have them come out, take a look, and give you a game plan for that area.
Yeah, because that could be a really, I mean, that's a nice large area. That could be really pretty.
Absolutely. For sure.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Old Brick Botanical Gardens in Madison, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Old Brick Botanical Gardens in Madison. And the gardens at Old Brick are looking fabulous at this time of the year, aren't they, Jeff?
They really are. I mean, I know we've had an overabundance of rain in many parts of the state. My heart goes out to especially the southern part where they've had so much flooding. But here in Madison, I think we've had rain every time it's just started to dry out. We got a little. Now I think we have more coming today again. But so turn off the faucet. But because of that, our plantings are very healthy. I'm not saying that we don't have some fungal diseases going. I think our crab apples are showing some of that. But you know, good with the bad. But the gardens are really looking nice, and one of my favorite gardens right now is our gravel garden. We have several at Old Brick, but the one right out front and center, right at the visitor center when you walk
that's
in.
That's really pretty.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Talk about that. What is a gravel garden, and describe that for people?
You bet. It's kind of a plant. It's a system where really the gravel serves as a mulch, and so we prep the site by removing the existing vegetation, but the existing soil can stay. And then we create a border around the edge if we need be. Sometimes we have the foundation of a building or a stone wall or something that's existing. We can use that as an edge. But if it's an open bed, we use boulders. We can use anything that will get up to about 6 inches high. So why is that? Because when the next step then is to bring in a chip gravel, think mm-hmm. of pea gravel works as well. We found that this quartzite chip is a good stone to use, and it's a stone that won't break down over time, so you don't want something soft. And then we put it down 4 to 5 inches deep, and this is about a quarter inch in size. Okay. And so think about it as like marbles in a jar. It's a wash gravel. So the airspace will always be maintained between each piece of gravel, which is important because that is our weed seed barrier, if you will. So if a weed seed drops on top of that gravel, it has to germinate, go all the way down, you know, 4 or 5 inches, root in, become established. That's a pretty tough thing to do. Not that it doesn't happen from time to time. Once all the gravel's in place, then we use, like I was saying earlier, just a plug size plants, about 2.5 inches in diameter and about 4 inches deep. So we just sort of dig like a dog with our hands, drop that plant in. It doesn't have to touch the bottom soil necessarily. Roots are always going to grow down. And then right after we plant, it needs a lot of water. And that's like so counter to what we say, because the whole idea behind these gardens, not only that they're low maintenance from a watering and fertilizing standpoint, but from the fact that they can live on what they get from Mother Nature. Okay, so, but in the beginning, they're surrounded by a sea of gravel. So we got to get those roots down into that soil below. And once they are, it's up and running. So the gravel garden that I was talking about out front was put in the summer of 2014. So a few seasons later now, we actually hardly watered it at all last year, and now the plants are really getting established. And you can't just throw anything in there. It's no. Got to be a plant that is adapted to droughty conditions. So we use actually a lot of native prairie plants, but not strictly so. We're using plants native to other parts of the world that are adapted to those dry conditions. And I'll tell you what, I mean, it
really
is just
pretty.
Just beautiful. And we plant close together. We plant on about anywhere from 10 to 12 inch centers, so it fills up quickly. And so I think when I first talk about gravel gardens, I do a lot of lecturing around the Midwest especially, and people see it for the first time, and they expect to see like a rock garden, you know, lots of stone, lots of gravel. In this situation, once it's mature, you don't see that at all. It's just, you see green and flowers, and you see all the beauty, and the gravel's just there as a necessary and very important part of the plant community that we're developing to keep the weeds down to a minimum. So typically, if we pull weeds, it's in the crowns of plants. And in the first year or two, most of those weeds that we are pulling were sort of the bonus gifts we got when we bought the plants, because they were the seeds sitting at the base of the plant when it went in, and they germinate. But you pull those, get rid of those, and then you get very, very little maintenance. So in almost 5,000 square foot garden, which that garden is, last year I think maybe we put 6 hours into to maintaining that through the season. Then the biggest chore is cleanup in the spring. So we let it go through the winter, because I love plants in their dormant state with all the seed heads, and all those things are so beautiful.
Me too.
Yep. And in the spring, it's a very, very thorough cleanup. We get in there. We actually had we get a volunteer group from Fiskars who are based here in Madison. They come out with 10, 15 people, and we just snip through them and lightly rake them. We go back with a blower and a rake, a two-man crew, get as much organic matter out of that system, because that's our enemy. That's what could build up to be a soil, so to speak, where the seeds will germinate later. All that comes out. And then we just enjoy the rest of the season. And it's amazing. You know, one of the things I dislike the most about gardening is mulching. You know, every year we mulch our beds, where it's there, and it's there for forever.
And, you know, that time of the year, you're more excited and enthused about getting out anyway.
Right.
As opposed to late in the year.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the other thing about them is bulbs do fantastically. You know, almost all of our bulbs that we use in gardening want to be dry when they're not growing. They're adapted to dry conditions. In nature, a bulb does its thing in the spring when it gets rain and sends up flowers or leaves and flowers and does its thing and then goes dormant. Well, when it's dormant, it wants to be dry, not wet. Yeah. And oftentimes we lose bulbs because they rot away during the season over with too much moisture. So in this situation, the bulbs just do fantastically.
Yeah.
And so you have that spring show as well.
There you go. Jill, do we have photos up of the gravel garden? I haven't looked yet to see. We may or may not. We can. She'll put some up.
Great.
She said
great.
She'll put some up.
Fantastic.
Of the Obrick gravel garden. So
or better yet, just come out and see them yourself.
Yeah, that's an even better idea.
Right.
Oh, man, it is a really cool place to visit. Joan in Superior, it's your turn. Hi, Joan.
Hi. First, I've got a couple comments about paths mowing through.
Yeah.
I mean, that does make a big difference because it looks to the city like it's supposed to look that way.
Good
point. Compared to just a big field of grass that they want to come and mow down.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have a sign, I think, from the Nature Conservancy or some group similar to that says our space is like a urban wildlife area.
Mm-hmm.
And that lets people know walking by that, yeah, it's supposed to look that way.
But you might want to get one of those, you know, monarch signs too. That's, you know, monarchs are the poster child for every insect out there right now, and that's mm-hmm. a good thing because people love them and they think it's such a fantastic story of their migration, which I do too. And so,
yeah.
Boy, everybody's into the monarch, so putting a sign up like that might help too.
But anyway, my backyard, which is also non-mown, is being taken over by jewelweed for about the past 4 years. And 3/4 of it is jewelweed, and then 1/4 of it has been taken over by Japanese umbrella plants. I don't know what the real name of it is, but they don't bother me. But everything else is covered in jewelweed, and I don't know how to get rid of it.
Well, it's a plant that's easy to pull, I'll say that. I mean, it sounds like it's at the point where it has seeded everywhere, and those little seed pods, if you know, they're like impatience, and if you touch them, mm-hmm. they explode and expel the seed to several feet. You know, without using like a pre-emergent herbicide, which I wouldn't do, I think your only option really is to be pulling them. And hopefully if you do it over a number of seasons, you'll reduce the weed seed population in that area and start to go down. Most jewelweed thrives under higher moisture conditions. So in a season like this, we're getting lots of water from the sky all the time, I can think it would be a good banner year for it. And one of the things that we said earlier, you know, we've had a lot of rain at Obrick. It's been great for the plants, but it's also been great for the weeds. And so we've been extra, you know, had to put a lot of extra time into weeding this season. There's no doubt about it. And that's just the bad.
Just the way it is.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Joan, for calling. And let's go to Patrick in Appleton next. Patrick, hi to you.
Hello. I'm calling about, I have an avocado tree that's in a pot. I keep it inside in the winter and put it out in the summer. It's about like 8 or 10 years old. And I'm just wondering, would I ever expect to get any fruit from it? Or is there any special maintenance that I should be doing with it?
Now, that's a great question, and one of which I have no idea. Avocados are a little out of my realm, but I'm wondering if they are dioecious. I don't know if you know this, Larry. Dioecious means that, you know, plants have separate sexes, so there's male plants and female plants, or even if they're not, oftentimes they need to be cross-pollinated by another of the same species to produce fruit, but I don't know anything about
avocados. And it would depend, too. Did you just take an avocado from the grocery store and start it?
Yeah, my mom started from a grocery store avocado from a seed for my girlfriend and I at the time, now my wife. And we've kept it as a little, memento of my mom,
I have not, I've tried it a number of times and I've never gotten an avocado. And I think the avocados that you get in the store may not always be the type that would produce fruit in the end.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
I wasn't sure about that.
Yeah. And usually
it's about 6 feet tall.
Yeah.
It's pretty huge.
And you know, where they're grown, the growing season is long and the light intensity is high and more heat. All those things make a huge difference in producing fruit. But there is this thing called the World Wide Web. And I bet if you typed in, how do I get my avocado to fruit? you probably will find something there.
Yeah, it got pretty in-depth pretty quickly. Okay, well, thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot for calling.
Oh, boy. Well, I don't have any avocado trees right now. I've got limey, my lime
tree.
Oh,
of course you do.
Limey's producing some limes right now. Yeah. I set her out a few weeks back or a couple weeks back, and she already had quite a few limes, half a dozen or so.
Oh, man, that's that. You could have a few gin and tonics or maybe even a mojito if you have that many.
So I always look forward to, and it's always a lot of fun to have your own lime. So I can see why he wants the avocado. Lynn emailed to say she has hostas at the base of her large oak and maple tree. Should she be concerned that this will hurt the tree? It'll compete with the tree for moisture.
Yeah, but I don't think that would be a problem. And so often people have, bluegrass lawns right up to the trunks, and those plants are very heavy users of nitrogen and water. Hostas, no. And when we think about an oak in its native habitat, it's not growing by itself with nothing underneath it. It's growing with plants all around it. And so I have no problem with that. I'm sure that plant will be just fine. And oaks are, so well adapted to our conditions. And
and oaks are one tree where you would use a tree dressing at sort of in summertime if you have a damaged oak.
Yeah, good point. We were just talking about damage to trees at this time of year, not using tree wound paint or wound dressings. But yeah, oaks and elms, right, Larry, would be the two that you would use if you had wind damage, which we've had a lot of storm damage this year, and especially just recently around Madison. So at that point, you'd cut them tight and dress it.
Talking today with Jeff Epping. Jeff is Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. If you haven't visited the gardens, I hope you will. Jeff Epping, our guest for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and happy to have with us Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. We've spent some time talking about moving away from grass lawns. We've talked about gravel gardens and no-mow and all kinds of things. But we'll take other flower and shrub questions as well from you if you would like to join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Email us too at ideas@wpr.org, or if you want to post on our Facebook page, the title, The Larry Mueller Show. Patty emailed to ask Jeff about the lily turf area near the Thai Pavilion, and this is at Olbrich Gardens.
Mm-hmm.
How hardy is it? Can it be grown in the Stevens Point area? And where can she get plants or seeds?
Yeah, so the plant that she is talking about is liriope, or sometimes down south they call it liriope. So it's a liriope spicata, S-P-I-C-A-T-A. And that's important because there's a lot of liriopes out there that are not hardy for us, and this one is definitely. We have never seen any injury at the garden, even in the most severe open winters. So I think you'd have a pretty good shot at it. I can't speak from personal experience because I'm not up there. But the one nice thing I like about that plant is it is so vigorous, and it just chokes out all the weeds that might come up in there. And we even have it under a lot of trees where you would typically find a lot of seeds coming out, germinate and growing. So in that instance, we mow it in the early spring, and that's it. And that's it for the season. And it's an aggressive plant. So, I mean, it's not one, and I've heard people say, so I put it in my perennial garden, and it ran everywhere. And I said, yep, that's what it does. But if you put it in a situation like we have, bordered on at least a couple sides with a walkway, then you only have to edge, the sides that are on the open. But what do we do with our bluegrass turf?
Yeah.
We have to edge that on, all the time if you want to maintain perennial beds next to it or that sort of thing. So it's nothing new. It's just a different mindset. So great plant, and it's truly evergreen. So through the winter, it'll stay nice and green. And then by spring, it starts to look a little ratty. We mow it off. We just use a regular mower that we use on our turf, raise it up to the highest setting. You might have to mow it a couple times, rake it in between, and then it's nice and tidy and good to go.
There you go. Mm-hmm. There we go. Ray in Oak Creek has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Ray. Thank you for calling.
How you doing, Larry? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I planted some peonies this fall, and they only got about a foot tall. I don't know. Do they have to get established, or am I doing something wrong?
Yeah, I don't think that's unusual for planting peonies, which are typically fall planted. It'll take a few years for them to get up to full size. I know we put in a nice collection. We focused on cultivars that Roy Clem and some of his best friends hybridized. So Roy is a great nurseryman. And then if you want some really great peonies, check out Song Sparrow Nursery. They have a website. It's all mail order nursery. They're near Janesville.
Farm Sparrow?
Song, S-O-N-G, Song Sparrow. Like the bird.
Okay.
Yep. And they have a great website and one of the greatest collections of peonies and daylilies and all unusual, very unusual plants that are just fantastic. But anyway, in the first couple of years, they were fairly small. But once they get going, and if you were to come out and look at them now, they're absolutely beautiful and full and healthy. And so, just got to be patient.
All right, great. Thanks.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in too, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. I know we've got some questions up on Facebook, but I can't quite get my eyes over there because I'm having trouble with my microphone. I know Karma, in particular, she said she's doing a page. This is going back to lawns. She's doing a page on her garden so that residents in the area can be inspired to do
like buffers of prairie flowers.
Yeah. So she's doing a, probably online, huh?
Yeah.
She said she's doing a page on it. So that's kind of cool.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So again, and you know what? There's a lot of good publications out there that exist. The DNR has done some great work. The UW Extension. I know, Larry, you're always making people aware of that because no use in recreating the wheel sometimes. I mean, experts have really made it easy for us. So yeah, check those two sources out. And again, you know, it's great to find experts in your area who develop these lists or brochures rather than somebody from another part of the country where those plants may not be applicable to our gardening conditions.
And we've got some great organizations here in the state, you know, citizen organizations.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, you can almost always find one in your area that some sort of horticulture group that's dealing with plants, and they're always happy to
help out. Very true. I know in the Madison area, we have the Wisconsin Hardy Plant Society. There's the plant society for just about every group of plants. you'll never be for lack of knowledge.
And the other is the master gardeners that are part of UW Extension. They're always happy to help, and the Master Garden Clubs around the state are a wonderful organization.
Right. I think there's one in every county, or some of them team up. But I actually do a lot of my lecturing to the annual symposia of the various Master Gardener groups in Illinois, Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan, all over the Midwest. And, they are a great group. Very nice. I love speaking to the master gardeners because they're so hungry for knowledge and awesome.
And they're fun to talk to.
Absolutely.
Kay and Madison, let's go to you. Hi, Kay.
I have a beautiful Weigelia bush that has gorgeous flowering on it. When is the best time to trim that back?
Typically, deciduous shrubs like Weigelia is, or Forsythia, or Viburnum, any of that group of deciduous shrubs that lose their leaves every fall, go dormant. The dormant season is when typically you would prune those plants, and we use something called renewal pruning. Where you take out about a quarter to a third of the oldest canes on any of these suckering shrubs. Lilac is another good example. And so that way, You never have canes in that plant that are older than, you know, 3 to 4 years old. And it sounds like, wow, there'd be nothing left of it. But in fact, the plants are super healthy. They are flowering and have foliage from the very base up to the top. We control the height that way, so they're very manageable, and they tend to be healthier because that new growth is more resistant to insects and disease and that sort of thing. So, yeah, renewal or rejuvenation pruning is what it's often called, but dormant season is the best time.
There we go. Thanks, Kay. Jimmy in Valley Junction, we're on to you now. Hi, thank you for calling, Jimmy.
Yeah, I had a question on ferns. I have some swampland, and I see ferns down there, but they don't seem to grow behind my house on the hill, but I see them in other hilly areas. Is there a difference between those types of ferns, and is there a commercial kind that I could get to maybe start them growing?
You bet. There's actually, you know, many, many different species of ferns, and they can vary very, you know, greatly in the conditions that they thrive in. So some, like you say, grow in those wetter conditions. Some are very drought tolerant. Some are in between. Most are wanting to be in shade, but some are more sun tolerant than others. So, go to your local garden center. I always like to frequent the, you know, hometown garden centers rather than the big box stores, because those are the people who do this for a living. The people that are selling those plants, they know the plants, they can give you advice. And like Larry mentioned earlier, there's a lot of plant societies and garden clubs that if you could hook up with some of those people or master gardeners, they would be able to give you some ideas of which ferns grow best in your area based on what they're doing, what they're growing, firsthand experience, and that goes a long way.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Doug in Mount Horeb, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Doug.
Hi. So I've got a question about how exactly you do create a no-mow lawn. You've talked about fescue and had some really creative ideas about putting bulb particles in with the grass and so forth, and you've come right up to it, but I'm still waiting to hear how do you actually do it. I've got Kentucky bluegrass wrapped around the whole house and out into the field, and there's probably 2 acres of it, and I'm doing it with a hand mower, which is great exercise, but at this point in my 70s, I'm thinking, well, a riding mower, a big one's going to cost me $5,000. Maybe a no-mow lawn could be put in for $5,000.
There you go. Right.
Yeah.
Let's see, if we're going to seed into a fescue, say a fine fescue blend, or a turf-type tall fescue, which is very drought-tolerant as well. So that's a decision you have to make, and maybe come on out to Old Brick and see those two examples you're nearby. You can make that decision for yourself. But basically what we would do is we would kill the existing turf in a big area like you're talking about. What we do is we'd spray glyphosate or Roundup in the later part of the season, so end of August to mid-September. We would spray, we would kill off that existing turf. And then what we found to be the best is to dormant seed in right into that. You don't have to rototill it all up and all those things. You just let that brown and sit for maybe 3 weeks or so. And then later in the fall, so we don't want the seed to germinate after we plant it when we do a dormant seeding. We want to go in with they call it a slit seeder, or it's a machine that you would rent. It makes little furrows. You just walk behind, self-propelled. It deposits the seed right into the existing soil. And then you wait. And then next spring, that seed will germinate as conditions are perfect for it. As the temperatures are warm enough, and typically when we get most of our rain is in the spring. So that's the advantage to dormant seeding. If you wait till spring, which isn't a terrible option, but sometimes it's so wet you can't get in to do to work the soil, to get the seeding done, and then you miss that opportunity where the growing conditions are most favorable. You kind of miss that window. But with that said, you can still do it in the spring. You know, summer would be the worst time to do it because it's, you know, hot and dry and that sort of thing.
Yeah, there we go.
That makes sense.
Great. Thanks for the advice.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Let's go to Jeff in Germantown. Hi, Jeff.
Oh, hey, Larry. I got you on speaker. Is the sound okay?
Yep, you're okay.
All right. Well, I called up earlier and talked to Jill, and she helped me figure out what weed I was talking about that I saw on a Japanese cooking show, and they were cooking with burdock root, and I wondered if your guest knew anything about when would be a good time to pick that root for trial and error in a cooking recipe.
Burdock root is something that is usually collected in the spring when the plants are fairly young. They're tastier then,
mm-hmm.
and they don't get bitter that the later roots get. Later on in the season, they get a little bitter. So at least that's my experience.
Yeah, I'd be honest, I've never tried it, but typically that would be, you know, as the season grows, because I pull them because they can be pretty weedy. When you pull them, they have a big old carrot-like taproot, and typically as the season progresses, those get a little more fibrous and tough and that sort of thing. So a lot of and people who eat garlic mustard, you know, which is a real weed here, but it's best in the spring. Otherwise it gets way too strong if you wait too far into the season. So I'm not sure this would be a good time or not.
You could try it.
Give it a shot.
It's a little late.
It's easier to recognize in the, you know, as the year progresses. I've never really looked for them early enough in the season to know what they might look like, but I know where I can find pictures.
Yeah, sure? Right. And typically they look like rhubarb, right? The big old leaves.
Oh, yeah.
Leaves,
there
right?
you go.
Yeah.
That's what everybody, you know, thinks. And
jogging my memory. That's what Jill did earlier when she reminded me that it might be burdock. And I said, I couldn't remember when I called in to begin with.
Right.
And I got the question about asking about the when it'd be ready to pick, and I appreciate your help. Always like your show, Larry.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Appreciate it. And, you know, why not give it a shot? I mean, it doesn't turn poisonous as the year goes on.
Right, right. So. No, fun. Yeah, that's what gardens are for, right? You got to eat too.
Karen in Watertown, thank you for calling.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I actually have a question, and then I have a comment.
Okay.
First, the comment. When the woman called regarding the pruning, when the proper time would be to prune the Ligalia, it's been my experience that that's a, you know, it's a late, like an early summer flowering shrub, but like lilacs and our Carlisi viburnum, I thought that those all bloom on the new wood that grows during the growing season. So the most appropriate time to prune them to receive the most flowers the following spring would be right after flowering. And then if there is some, you know, more rejuvenative pruning that's required, that could be done. That could be done later dormant. But if you're just pruning a shrub to shape, I thought it's best to do it right after flowering.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like that clarified, and then I'll wait for that answer, and then if you have time, I'll ask you my question.
Okay.
Well, yeah, when early spring shrubs, that's often the recommendations. Wait until they flower, and then renewal prune them. But you know what? It's harder to do then. Yeah. I have more time during the dormant season. And when you have a garden as extensive as Olbrich, you do your pruning when you have the most time, and that's during the dormant season. And I have, like, say, forsythia, our plants are so healthy that if we remove the older growth, take it out of there in the winter, I still have plenty of buds on the stalks that I save, or the canes that I save. So I'm not worried. And the other thing, if you prune after they flower, what happens right after they flower as they're just finishing up? They're sending out new leaves. And if you are pruning then, you're knocking off a lot of the leaves and damaging the plant in that way when you're removing the stuff you cut out. So personally, I don't agree with that philosophy, but to each his own. The other thing, if you prune when they're dormant close to spring on, say, a forsythia, you can force those into flower in your house. And that's kind of, and we do that for our spring flower show every year. We go out and cut them early and do that. So, but yeah, oftentimes if we're cutting, you said shaping shrubs, you know, unless you're making a hedge or something, I'm not a big fan of shaping a shrub, because the beauty of any plant is its natural form. And if, say, a good example is a bridal spirea.
Yeah.
They have this beautiful flowing form, and when they're in flower, they're absolutely gorgeous. And it always kills me when I see somebody out with head shears shaping them into a little meatball, because they're not only cutting all the flower buds off, they've just completely ruined the natural form of the plant. So, you know, I'm kind of a snob that way, Larry. But you know, enjoy the plants for their natural beauty, and select the plants that you want in your landscape based on how they grow at their ultimate size and shape. And I think it'll be a lot less work too, to be quite honest. Now, if you're making a hedge or something, then I understand.
I'm not talking about pruning, like shaping in that way. Absolutely, I agree with you. Keep the natural shape of the shrub. But I just thought it was, you know, that it's been my experience that's the way I do it, that I hand prune, not shear. I mean, the only thing I shear that's aggravating is usually if I'm helping someone else.
Right.
But yeah, I understand. Anyway, recommend the way to kill Japanese knotweed.
How do you kill Japanese knotweed? That's the question. You were breaking up there, Karen, so I'm sorry I had to kind of cut you off there.
Yeah. I'll be honest with you, we don't have any on the property. I know it's a tough one to get rid of. I've heard, you know, using some of the really heavy-duty herbicides like Garlon or Tordon, which I don't recommend ever using if you can help it, may be the only solution for that. Larry, you may know more about that from past guests.
Well, the DNR website has some information on dealing with those invasive plants, as I have the invasive folks from DNR on the show from time to time.
You bet.
And so the recommendations that they have are posted on the DNR website. Just look for, there's a section on invasive plants.
There you go.
And you'll get the information. I hope you'll get the information you need right from that. So thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Jeff, what's coming up now at the garden? We got the butterflies.
Yep, we have the butterflies going on now, but end of August. I don't know if you've ever been over for an event we have called Gleam,
which is that's fun.
Yeah, we bring in artists from, actually they're all over the country, and actually even one from England this year. And their art exhibits feature light. So the whole exhibit is about coming to the garden at night and wandering through all of the garden. We have a great landscape lighting system through the garden, and of course we add more with this event. So that goes from August 31st to the end of October, October 28th. And then this year we have Thai Fest, which we don't have every season. So we have this great celebration out in the Thai garden. We have authentic Thai dancers, music, food. It's a fantastic day, and that's September 24th.
Check that out. I have not done that one. This is new this year.
Well, we've done it in the past, but this is this extra special one
back
this year. Oh, yeah, it's a good one. You'll love it.
Jeff, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Jeff Epping is Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. If you haven't been there or haven't been there in a while, I highly recommend you take a look, because there's lots to see there. Monday we'll be talking about what we do know and what we don't know about our universe. There's a really cool new book out on that, so I'm looking forward to it. In the meantime, stay with us.